This is the continuing oral history interview of Shirley Bridge, and we are on mini disc tape number 2. So we were talking about cognacy. I'm not sure I fully understand what that is.
Well, you know the drugs that they do in naturopathic medicine, that's what they were. We didn't make such a big fuss about it. We were very happy when they came out with drugs that were not natural because you could do them faster. And I remember there were no drugs for hypertension in the early 70s. No, it wasn't the 70s. It was the early 60s. And one of the doctors wanted to find an experimental drug. So there was a drug being grown in India called Rauwolfia serpentina. And we sent for it. And it came in little packages, little green tablets. Some of them were smashed. We got them in the pharmacy, and he prescribed them. But there was nothing against it in those days. Well, it did help. And the next year, lo and behold, Squibb came out with a drug called Raudixin, which was the active ingredient of Rauwolfia serpentina. And if we were smart, we would have made money on it. But it was really interesting because that was the first drug that was used, and I think throughout the country.
So while you were being educated in pharmacology, what were the circumstances then for what diseases were being focused on, and what kind of education were you given then that might be different today?
Well, there were not too many drugs. We focused on sulfa drugs because that's what we had. And then penicillin came in when I worked at Swedish Hospital when I was still a student. And I remember one of the doctors came in. We had so little penicillin in penicillin tablets or injectables. And his wife was ill, and he wondered if he could have some. And of course it was rationed, and I said, oh, of course. But he was very nice. He wasn't going to take it if there was somebody more ill than his wife, but she was plenty ill. So that was the thing. There were no wonder drugs at the time, and there was no Acromycin or Terramycin. Those were wonder drugs at the one time. And we didn't have a lot of blood tests for what was wrong with you at the time, so pharmacy was rather primitive. Now it isn't at all. It's way ahead of me. I can't even remember how these people can keep all of these drugs in mind. And the cytochromes and all of the things, you know, they do organic chemistry, but they have a rhyme and reason to what organic chemistry is now. And if you took zoology, you must know, you know, how zoology has changed. Genetics had made a lot of difference in everything. And we all took, you said you took pre-med. We took pre-med in pharmacy. There were two women in the class. They were both daughters of doctors, and they became physicians. But they were the ones who had money and entrance, you see.
Were your aspirations similar? Did you want to go to medical school?
Yeah, there was no medical school here. I did very well, and I probably could have gone. There was only one woman in the first class, I think, and she was a pharmacologist. But there were not very many women.
Was pharmacology taught in a way that you were involved mostly in the science of it, or the patient caregiving
side
of it?
No, it was all the science of it. Pharmacology was a study of the drugs that were not... were not the powdered drugs, you know, or the drugs, the naturopathic drugs. These were drugs that were developed otherwise, and it was the effect of these drugs on the body that you studied.
How did you study that? Did you inject? Did you dissect? What did you do?
Well, we didn't do it. The pharmacology professor did and gave us his, you know, his notes, and this woman who was his assistant gave us the notes. Then we went into class like physiology, and we would kill a poor cat and dissect the cat.
You'd kill it right there?
Yeah, she'd kill it, and then they would take the organs and test some medicines on them. that was the way we did it.
What do you remember, since you mentioned that the ratio was 8 women to 80 or 72 men, mm-hmm. or whatever it is, what do you remember about the relations between the sexes, or how you were treated, or the expectations for your employment?
Well, we were treated well. It was wartime, and most of the class was gone to war. So the women who were left got good jobs, and it was a little different in pharmacy in those days, because there were drug stores that were prescription stores, and that's all they did were prescriptions. They only took prescriptions from the doctors, written and over the phone, and it's not like that now. And hospital pharmacy was women's work. My sister went to hospital pharmacy, and I went to the drugstore aspect of it, but they were only prescription stores, and that's all you did. And you made injectables, and you made eye solutions under a hood. It was a little different.
Now, I'm naive about this, so what do you mean by eye solutions under a hood?
Well, that was to keep it sterile. You would, I hope it was sterile, you would make a solution, an eye solution that was fairly sterile under the hood, and there were lights to keep it sterile, and you would put it in a bottle, and then you would fill the prescription.
For what kind of ailments?
Mostly just eye infections. Although we did some injectables, didn't do those too well.
Something was about to make you laugh, and I don't know what it was.
Oh, I don't remember either. I remember the thing I was thinking of. We also did manufacturing. I worked for a German pharmacist, a German-Jewish pharmacist, and we did a lot of mouthwashes, thiocodeine, which was a cough medicine. We did some vitamin B injectables, and so forth, and he wasn't afraid to do anything. Then we made suppositories. I had the suppository machine. And there was a little Jewish woman, I won't mention her because so many people must have known her, and she used to wear these heavy rubber stockings, and they were always too tight. So one day I got really upset with her. She brought it in for about the fifth time, so I took the stockings, put it on the suppository wheel, and went like that. Stretch it all right, and she was very happy. That's life.
So it sounds like you did have quite a bit of interaction, at least in your work life. Would you say that there was anything about your education at University of Washington that was unique in pharmacy? Did they have a particular direction, unlike other places that you might have gone?
I didn't even think about it. It was during the war. What they did make us do was come to graduation, because there were only 12 of us. And we took the state board. You know, when you take the state board now, you have a whole book of questions and answers. We had to dig through and get the answers, you know, through little pieces of paper. It was, they had just moved into this chemistry building, though, so we had good chemistry labs. Except that they had the, if you got yourself caught on fire, there was a blanket, you know, so you could wrap yourself in it. But there was no shower, you had to step in the sink. So that was a big, funny deal. In fact, it wasn't so funny because we did have an ether fire once and we had to get out of there. And I don't know how anybody would have been able to get into the sink to wash off.
I'm going to ask you a kind of odd question,
uh-huh.
which is the question of what is illicit drug and what is an illicit drug.
Mm-hmm.
How were you taught that? How did it play into what you thought about what you were doing? What did they say were drugs that shouldn't be used, and yet you had access to them? You know, can you talk about that a little bit?
You're talking about marijuana?
Well, I think that's one. I think there are other drugs as well that are behind the counter that are methadone, you know, things like that.
Well, there wasn't anything like that when I went to school.
But no. There was marijuana?
Well, yeah, yes, there was. And there was ergot and ergoapiol, but those were all on a prescription. Marijuana was just sort of just in the drug garden. But they always had cannabis, you know, and that cannabis was used for pain and drugs. There were no really illicit drugs, that nothing like ecstasy, nothing like methadone is still on prescription. I did work in a methadone program part of the time when I was out of school in the summer. I would work at this methadone program, which was called Puget Sound Special Programs, and it was run by a young woman doctor. And they used to, people would go in and get their methadone. Then I worked down the street for a little while in another prescription store, and they'd come in, see me, and walk right out again because they had prescriptions too.
What era was this? What time? What decade?
Oh, gosh. It must have been in the early 50s.
Hmm.
So I was really out of school.
Yes. But it sounds like you were part witness to the way that patients have been treated differently with different drugs over
mm-hmm.
the decades.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you might describe some of what you've witnessed in terms of those changes.
You mean the methadone program?
Methadone program, or how drugs have come in and out of fashion and or perhaps have been seen to be dangerous to people.
Well, all drugs are dangerous, and we always knew that. And drugs are dangerous because they are... they're not controllable, you know. We never worried as much about it as they do now. The methadone program was the last resort and still is for many people. In fact, we used to fill prescriptions for 3 people in the morning. I used to open the store, the prescription store, and there were 3 people there. There was a lady of the evening, and then there was a photographer, and then there was a gambler, and they'd all get... doctors wrote for morphine and for Dilaudid, and they'd get 16 each day, and it was legal. And one day, one didn't come in. He had been pushed down the elevator shaft for his pills, you know. Well, but one of the funny things is that one of the guys who got the pills came into the methadone program years and years later. And I said, "My God, what are you doing here?" I said, "Why are you still?" He said, "Well, I got scared because the only vein I had was a jugular left." So, you know, funny things happen. But there was no real regulation of the doctors either, and there were a lot of doctors who were addicts. None of the drugs were really regulated. You know, there would be a dose in the drug books, and you took it, and you didn't worry about the interaction. What drug interaction, you know? If the tube didn't explode when you added it, it was okay. There was very little done about drug interaction in those days.
When did that change?
Probably in the 70s, because some new drugs were coming in all the time. And I think probably the drug companies with their new drugs must have added to that. There's so many drugs now. Look at this book. And they all have
what book is that? The
well, I didn't take the. I have another one. But
Drug Information Handbook. That's just the pocket version.
And this is the pocket version.
That's quite thick. So I guess what I'm wondering about the role of a pharmacist in relationship to the doctor, to the nurse.
It's changed an awful lot.
What was it like when you started?
Well, you just filled the prescriptions and you didn't ask questions. And if the doctor wanted a prescription filled and you didn't like it, you did it anyway. And then you would say, "To hell with you, doctor," you know, and then you would call up again and find out if it was okay. But now it's changed a lot. The pharmacists go 6 years now, and you get a PharmD, a doctor of pharmacy. You are able to take blood pressure, and you're able to even prescribe somewhat. And you are able to, what else was it that we did? They took blood pressure, and they also took bone density. And you could, you could ask people in the pharmacy to take blood and check for diabetes. Well, you couldn't do those things before.
Why not?
Well, because the doctors had you by the neck. Nobody even thought about it. Although pharmacy, this old German pharmacist would, he would do things too. And we used to send a lot of injectables over that maybe other pharmacies would not send over. But, things have changed and are regulated so much by law now that you really do have to be careful. And we didn't have to worry about, I think we were insured for $300,000 when I left. Now you have to be insured for millions because you can get sued, the company can get sued, and the doctor can get sued all at the same time.
Within, I'd say there have been studies done in the Sephardic Jewish context of potions and things like that for the sick and for the ill, and there's mm-hmm. always mothers who prescribe certain things that maybe they have a basis in pharmacology and maybe they don't. Okay. And I'm just wondering whether or not anything in your upbringing or things that you've heard over the years from living here, are there home remedies?
Oh, of course. My mother used to make onion syrup for a cough. Oh, yes, indeedy. And they used to put mustard poultices on you.
What's that?
Well, mustard for your chest so you wouldn't get congestion. There were all sorts of home remedies. And I think some of them worked okay. But those are the two that I remember. It's like, yeah, they certainly kept people away from you. You wouldn't. And then they used to use garlic a lot for, you know, Alamin is garlic. It's a drug that they have over the counter. But people used to chew garlic because there was nothing else for blood pressure. And you could, they were maybe standing at the door and you could smell them as they came by to get their prescriptions. And that was used a lot. I think it still is by a lot of people. Ginkgo biloba, I think so many of these drugs now interact with your drugs that it's dangerous to use these naturopathic drugs. They can cause trouble, and there's not enough known about them yet, so there will be a book put out, I think.
But it's interesting, you were saying that when you first started studying that naturopathic remedies were part of your study. When did they fall out of fashion?
Well, they weren't really naturopathic. They were, digitalis is a drug that is made from nature, sure, but it isn't a naturopathic, when I was studying, was a dose, and it was a small dose, and naturopathic physicians gave small doses. The schools nowadays, they know a lot about the drugs that are going on, the drugs from nature. And we get courses on them too for in extracurricular activities. You know, we have to have 15 hours to keep our license, and they talk about the new drugs and the drugs sold over the counter, the you call them naturopathic. But they really aren't. They're just drugs made in nature. Naturopathic used to refer to a dose, a very small dose, and I guess it still does.
The efflorescence of homeopathic, naturopathic, acupuncture, alternative types of care uh-huh. have really blossomed in Seattle in particular. Uh-huh. How have you witnessed that, and can you describe in any way how you had an interaction with that as a pharmacist?
Well, of course we have. At Bastyr University, you know, is the home of the people who believe in these nature products, and they're very bright. We have had courses from them in the School of Pharmacy, and I have... I try to learn as much as I can. The problem is they don't tell you too many of the idiosyncrasies of those drugs or the interactions because they don't know, and that's the thing that worries us. Any other kind of medication. You want chiropractors, that's fine if you feel like it. Massage therapists. Well, physical therapists and massage therapists are different. Physical therapy you can't even get without a doctor's prescription. But, acupuncture is fine. Doctors will say if you have nothing else that will relieve pain, use it.
In terms of going back to the cannabis, how have you seen over the years the legalization movement and the use of it, prescriptions? Mm-hmm. What has it been used for? How has the perspective on that changed or stayed the same over time?
Well, everybody's afraid of cannabis, and I'm not too sure why. It's used in glaucoma a little bit. I don't remember whether they're using it to smoke or whether they're using the active ingredient Caninibal, I can't even pronounce it. And then for cancer, yeah, they use anything for that, you know, anything to take pain away.
So when you started out, was that something that was prescribed regularly?
No, but it was prescribed too. People all knew there were other drugs that were prescribed too. And there were drugs too, like Viagra. Yohimbin used to be a drug, and nothing is new under the sun, you know, if you're really looking for it. Did you ever learn about drugs yourself?
Not when I was studying zoology.
But you are now?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you then also, and then I'd like to talk a little bit about the factual part of your work experiences, where you worked and so on and so forth, but in terms of women's drugs, can you talk a little bit about, there have been drugs for migraine and menstruation and these things, and what were you taught about specific women's ailments, if at all, when you were in school, and how has that changed over time?
Well, we didn't talk too much about it, but when I got out of school, there were a lot of women in my generation who used hormones, you know, during childbirth, and a lot of these women had children who had cancer. It really was too bad, and we didn't have. They had just drugs for women, you know, contraceptive drugs had just come into being, and there's still problems with them, but there was nothing like that. And we had drugs for people who wanted to, there were people who did abortions, you know, which were all illegal until 1970 when the Women's Commission, when I was on that, we got a law passed.
There were drugs for women's abortion?
That was the only thing you could have. There was a drug called Ergot, and then you had quinine, and those are the two drugs that were used before you had an abortion. Abortion was illegal, but there were doctors who would do it.
So what is the veil? Is there a veil of secrecy around the use of these drugs? Is it a...
Not now, no.
But back then?
No, not really. They would write prescriptions for them. Everybody knew what they were being used for. There's nothing new under the sun. But they didn't use, they used a lot of stilbestrol and a lot of Premarin even then, and not knowing that it could lead to problems. Besides problems like that, too much of a hormone can give you cancer of the ovary, you know. And so people, you know, don't quote me on some of this because I'm way behind on some of it, but yeah, you do have to be careful.
So where was it that you had your main work experiences?
Well, when I got out of school, I worked at Swedish Hospital for a while. Then I went to, excuse me.
Gesundheit.
Thank you. Then I went to this prescription store and was there for about 20 years.
Then did it have a name?
Yes, it was called Colden and Lewis, and then it sold and was called Ted Wallace, and then sold and was called Peterson's, and I went along with each sale.
And what exactly is a prescription store? Most of us are not familiar with
that. Well, it only sells prescriptions. It didn't have any of the hardware you see in stores like Pay and Save or Fred Meyer, any of that. We did have, we used to make prescriptions too. We used to make our own line of cosmetics. But it was really mostly you fill doctors' prescriptions, and you had phones on the wall where doctors would call in and they'd want it right now. And so I went from there to Snow's Pharmacy. Mm-hmm. And in between times, you know, I had been ill because I've had 5 primary cancers. And so because I belonged to the union, they would pay you for being ill and pay for your medical. That's what he also got us that, Dave Beck.
Hmm. Now, what union did you belong to?
Well, it was called the Pharmacist Union, but it was AF of L and then AF of L and CIO. And it worked very well. And then in between times, I think I worked at Bartels in between. And what else did I work at? Oh, and then I went back to Swedish.
How were those different milieus different?
Well, there really wasn't. Swedish hospital pharmacy is something that is really different. And unless you're working in the outpatient pharmacy, you're stuck in a little hole and you make solutions for the floors, and I didn't care for that. Then I also went with somebody and we started a pharmacy at the Bon, which was a prescription pharmacy only.
Is there still a prescription pharmacy at the Bon?
No, it kind of petered out.
Who were your customers?
People from the Bon. You know, they would call, doctors would call in. We had a good practice there. And then afterwards, when I got sick again, then I just came back to Swedish for a while.
Mm-hmm. At what point and at what age did you first experience your illness, your first illness?
Mm-hmm. It was 45 years ago, let's see. I was about 34. And my son Dan was 9 months old and John was 4 years old. So.
Well, I think
that was my first one.
And what do you remember about that time that happened, that you recognized that you were not feeling well?
Well, I went to a woman doctor who saved my life several times, Elizabeth Hauser, and she checked me and she told me that she thought there was something there, and I went to a surgeon that I knew who was very cooperative, and we did it in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. Was there... are you talking about breast cancer?
No, it was cancer of the colon, the rectum. I've had a colostomy for 45 years.
Huh. What was the, being a pharmacist and knowing quite a bit about medicine, what was the discourse around colostomy at that time?
Well, you either lived or you died, you know, and I talked to the guy who was the head of a tumor institute at Swedish, which was a little place at the time, and he said I had a 25% chance, but, you know, the thing is I'm not introspective, I told you, so we just go on. And then I had another problem. I had cancer of the uterus, and then cancer of the breast, and then cancer of the bladder. And then this last one was cancer of the cecum, which spread. So I had my first chemo when I was an old lady. So that was about three years ago.
So you only took chemotherapy on... in the latter.
Yeah, when it spread. I was very lucky until then.
So for the first, can you break up the times in which you experienced these? You said the first one, you were a young mother.
Yeah, that was 1955, I guess. And then it was 1960 and 1963. And then later, you know, when I was a grown old lady, I got cancer of the bladder in the 1990s. Oh, I forgot. I did have one non-malignant. I had my gallbladder removed. Lucky me. And that was about it.
So for each of the early operations, essentially they were operations to remove something. You're a very strong woman, and what was it like for you to go through this time, and as a mother, as a working woman, how did you manage it?
Well, I just kept working. The thing is, my husband was very supportive, and the kids were supportive, and I just did what I had to do. You know, I don't think about things. I just do them. Hmm. Yeah, if you sit down and you join a group and you try to be introspective, you're not going to get anything done. You know, I have counseled people who want to be counseled, and how to help your colostomy, and some people just never get it. It's hard to do, even after 45 years. And so you just, you know, you either make up your mind you're going to live a normal life or you're not going to. And I don't know whether that's the way most people think or not. And I've been very fortunate because so far I've been okay. But we don't know, you know.
Has having cancer over the course of your lifetime, has that influenced your choices in terms of how you've reared your children, how you've interacted with the community, organizations you've gotten involved with?
Mm-mm, not at all. The thing is that I try not to let it, because if, in fact, I don't even think about it, because if you do think about it, then you're going to be in trouble, and you're going to join a group, and you're going to talk about it, and why talk about it, you know? It's there, you accept it, and if you don't accept it, you're going to be in big trouble.
Well, it seems like you've made those choices witnessing other people who've made other choices.
Yeah, I'm sure that there, and I don't say mine is the right choice, it is for me. And of course, when you have chemo, you don't feel very good, and you never seem to get over it, so I can understand how people do things like this, especially the younger people.
I think what I want to do is stop here, and we'll pick up next session, because we've skipped over how you met your husband and having children and all that good stuff.
All that good stuff. He's better at that than I am.
Well, I think I want to thank you for this first session, Charlie.
Well, you're welcome.
This is the continuing oral history interview of Shirley Bridge. Today's date is August the 8th. The year is 2001. This is Pamela Brown Lavitt, oral historian for the Jewish Women's Archive Weaving Women's Words Project in Seattle. And I'm happy to see you again.
Thank you. Same here.
I wanted to ask you, when, where, and how did you meet your husband?
Well, we met at a picnic, a neighbor's picnic, around 1947. And I was with someone else, and he asked me to dance, and I said no. But he was persistent, and then at a wedding, he asked me again. This time I said yes.
Why'd you say yes that time?
Because he was a good dancer. And then we went on from there. He came down to where I worked to meet me and see what I did, because he was very interested even then in having women have a career and do what they wanted. So he knew what he was getting. And then we went out, and he asked me to marry him on the first date, and I laughed at him, because I said, oh, he was younger than I, and I thought, hey, this kid asks everybody to marry him, must be desperate. But it went on from there, and we finally got together and got engaged, and he just put the ring on my finger. We went up to see my parents in the apartment house, and up on Capitol Hill, where you live, and nobody seemed too interested, because I'd never told them who I was going with. I never talked about my dates. And so he came into a hostile environment, but my sister was in bed, and she turned over and said, oh, your ring's nice, good night. And my father said, are you marrying him for the ring? And my mother and aunt were a little nicer to him. And that was about the way we did it. And then we got married in 48. We got engaged in September and married in January. And since I was working across the street from Frederick and Nelson, all of the showers were across the street.
All of the showers? What do you mean?
Well, years ago, people used to give showers what they, so that when you got started in your married life, you would be able to have dishes and glasses, and you could see some of them here, and silverware. Nice gifts. My mother-in-law had a lot of friends who believed in giving showers for weddings. That was part of their pleasure, you know.
So where exactly did you have your shower?
Frederick and Nelson.
It was actually at the department store.
Uh-huh. They had a tea room up there. They had special rooms. It wasn't the only place, but that was one of the places. And they did it on my lunch hour, which was very nice of them. I know they didn't understand why I was working or anything about it. These are women who probably hadn't worked a day in their lives. So, but they were nice enough to understand that that had to get back. And so we had short lunches and short showers, so to speak. Hardly getting wet there.
So you've mentioned a couple times in that story that most of the women that you knew were not working. Can you talk about that?
No, not most of the women that my mother-in-law knew weren't working. My mother always worked. And and all the women I knew, all of my friends were women who worked in pharmacy. So, yes, they all worked, and they all continued to work. And who knew that I would do that, too? In fact, for a while I was making more money than he was. You know, those were the days.
How much money were you making back then?
Oh, my. I made $50 a week. That's a lot of money. I think I told you that for a long time, women pharmacists were getting less than men. So Dave Beck, who is a well-known union man here, he's also sort of a well-known character, sort of a racketeering character, got us equal pay for equal work. And so we were making what the men were making. And we sure didn't let that slip away.
Was that a struggle that you were involved in?
No, not really. It wasn't a struggle because unions were very strong. And it was a very good union. It gave us money when we were ill. When I was ill, and I was ill quite a bit, I got paid. When I, they also paid for your health and welfare, you know. So it was very nice. It was one of, he was very forward-looking. Unfortunately, Dave Beck was put in jail for income tax evasion, but he got out and was a great fan of the Mariners, so he lived his life fully, and I think he did a good job for the women. Whether it was intentional or just because he wanted a stronger union, I don't know.
So getting back to your courtship with Herb, what was Herb doing at the time?
Herb was, he was in his father's business. And his father was one of these old-fashioned guys who liked to tell his sons what to do. And when Herb was in the service, he got a letter from his father saying that he was a quarter owner of the business. And Bob got the same, Bob, who was his brother, got the same letter. And so when he came back, he was expected to stay in the business and work. And I guess that's what he did for a while. Years later, in the 50s, when they wanted to expand and his father didn't want to, didn't know how, why, we almost left the store. But instead of us leaving, his father was, he loved his family very much, even though he didn't show it often, and he left. And so he stayed on as a salaried employee.
And what was this business?
The jewelry business, Benbridge Jewelry.
Helicopters. What kind of expectations did you have, as well as your family have, around your marriage, who your marital partner would eventually be?
Well, I never thought much about getting married. That wasn't a priority with me. I would never have quit school even if Rockefeller came around, because it was too hard to get there. And I stayed out a year and a half to work two jobs. You know, when you really want something, you don't give it up. So it was just, I don't know if I'd ever gotten married if Herb hadn't come along and been a little persuasive. Because that was not what I really wanted. You know, it just didn't bother me. I guess I was one of the few women in college who didn't bother me.
And in terms of Herb's view of what it is that you would do after marriage, did he support the idea of your continuing to work, or is that a necessity at that point?
No, it wasn't a necessity. Yes, I told him that, well, that was one of the terms of the marriage. You would be interested to know, in our wedding ceremony, Rabbi Levine did it, and they always used to say, love, honor, and obey. And I said, I wouldn't go through the service if you said obey. I would just say no, and that would be the end of it. So he was a little upset, but he wrote obey out.
So what did he say instead, do you remember?
Love, honor, and cherish. So
what do you remember about your wedding?
Well, it was a bigger deal than I wanted it to be. We had it at the Olympic Hotel, and everybody sort of chipped in because my parents didn't have a lot of money, but it was nice. We had a reception in the foyer, and we had a sit-down dinner, you know, the regular. And then I went out of the, I'd only been to Oregon, and we went to California for our honeymoon and visited his relatives there, who nicely gave up their apartment so we could stay. And I saw San Francisco for the first time that my folks had come from, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the traveling. We drove in a little old Nash and had fun, you know, just going across. We didn't go too far, we just went to California, because you didn't have a lot of time in those days. 2 weeks was a long vacation.
What do you remember about those early days of negotiating your relationship?
Well, I don't think we negotiated very much. If I didn't like something, I just didn't do it. And I am a big arguer. I know that he was surprised. One day we were, this was before we were married, we were, he took me across the water to Bremerton because he was in the Navy and he enjoyed it and he stayed in. And there was a candy bar in the car and he said, "Oh, we're going to eat, don't eat that." And he kept saying, I said, "You stop this." I said, "If you want me to go out with you, you're not going to tell me what to do." And he was not used to being talked to that way. He was big man on campus or something.
Where do you think that you got this from, your strength and...
Oh, my mother was a very strong person. That's another story.
Do you want to tell that one?
Oh, I suppose. She actually was the one who pushed us into pharmacy, saying we should always be able to support ourselves and our children. But when Herb and I were... still engaged, one night he brought me in late, and she wasn't worried about what I was doing. I was old enough to do what I wanted, but she was worried about my physical body, you know. And I heard her kind of rumbling in the apartment, and Herb said, "Well, I said, go, leave, hurry." And he said, "No, I'm not going to run down the stairs." I said, "Yes, you are," and I was holding the door. And she was pulling on the other side, and she was not a little woman. So I said, "Go, because if you don't, you're going to get punched right down the stairs." So he ran down the stairs. It was a little different than his family. I came from a matriarchal society, and he came from a patriarchal society. His mother was a very gentle person.
So how did that manifest in your roles, either in terms of as being a couple and eventually in terms of parenting?
Well... we argued a lot. We still do. I don't mind arguing. I think that's a way to get things settled and get things off your chest. As far as parenting goes, Herb was born an Orthodox Jew into a Jewish community. He didn't really know anything about historical Judaism, and I went to temple, and I said, "I think it's a good idea for the children to learn about their Jewish roots, but they also ought to learn the history of Judaism." So we went to temple, and the boys were in the choir. They have good voices, and Herb taught in Sunday school, and he became a Reformed Jew. That's fine.
And in your home as well, were you Reformed Jews?
Yes, my mother and father. We didn't have room in the apartment for two sets of dishes. Mother came from an Orthodox family. Father coming from Chernobyl, I don't know what it was, you know, they ate what they could. But, yes, we had no trouble with that at all. Herb is not ultra-religious, and neither am I.
Did you discuss having children?
Yeah, we did. He had to talk me into it.
Really? So initially you didn't want children?
I didn't really care one way or another. No.
Why do you think that was, Shirley?
Well, I'm just not the maternal type. I never have been. I don't know about you, but, you know, cuddly little kids. I like cuddly little kids about 15 or 16 so I can talk to them and argue with them. But I know a lot of people like babies. But, no, I like a child when a child is old enough to think and talk.
So how did Herb convince you?
I don't know. I can't remember. It's been a long time ago.
So how long had you been married before you got pregnant?
About 3 years.
And who was your first child?
John. John was... my aunt was my babysitter, and my father lived with us because my mother passed away just before John was born. And she liked to eat, and she fed him. He was a round little porker. He was very bright. Funny kid because he couldn't walk until he was two. Herb went away to Korea, and when he came back, he ran toward him and fell. And but he could talk when he was 9 months old. So I'd take him to the doctor, and the doctor would hear him talking and say, "Come on in." I said, "He can't walk." But you know, some are slower in other ways.
So how long was Herb away in the service?
almost 2 years. Let's see. The baby was almost 2 years, a year and a half. He was in Korea. Somebody came to the door. I said, you better get home because I think you have an official package here. And he was called back into Korea. And he served there. And when he came back, he stayed in the reserve. And I got a leave of absence of a month and went down to be with him. And my aunt came down with John. They were very good to me where I were. And then when we came back, he wanted to stay, and I wasn't too happy about it. But then as he got up in rank, he wanted to leave. And I said, no, you're not going to. If this guy could make admiral, so could you. So he stayed in and became an admiral. But we were in the service for a while.
You mentioned that your father lived with you mm-hmm. after your mother died. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the circumstances that led up to that? Because you mentioned to, I think it was Goldie, that family. You had a lot of family living with you during the course of...
Oh, yes, we did. Well, first of all, we had his second cousin living with us. She was a young woman who had rheumatoid arthritis and was on crutches. She came to us and she stayed with us from the age of 15 till she was about 19 and went to the university here. And Father was very, very good with young people, and he was good with the children. You know, he was a homemaker himself. You know, he would do our ironing, and he would help with the cleaning. And he had his own room and his own sitting room, but he was very helpful. We were lucky to have him, because I would come home from work, and, you know, you would cook the meal. I think I told you this. And there was no freezer at that time and anything like that. So you cooked the meal when you got home from work, put it in the Frigidaire, and then he would put it in the oven for us. So when we got home, he'd have eaten before. When we got home, he would have it all, you know, warmed up for us. And, of course, I cooked for him because nobody else seemed to care. But my Dan to this day said, I still remember double-killed chicken because we used to pot roast chicken. And it worked out pretty well. And when we moved from the house in Montlake, we moved over to Herb's family home, because by that time his mother had died and his father wasn't keeping the house very well. My father finally passed away, and then his father came to live with us for 4 years too. So we always had quite a few people living with us.
How long did your father live with you?
About 20 years. He was very good to us. He did all my clothes.
So
I was lucky.
Tell me a little bit about your family life. So John is the firstborn. When did you decide to have another child?
In 4 years. I wasn't in a hurry.
Was the childbirth experience, pregnancy, was that a good experience for you, or was it a difficult experience?
I never thought about it. You know, when you're pregnant, and it's just like having surgery. There's nothing that you can do. Just go along with it. When I had John, they used to knock you out. With Dan, I didn't have a lot of help, but, you know, I don't think it made any difference.
Did the doctors advise you back then certain things about giving birth or breastfeeding, things of that nature?
Well, I wasn't going to breastfeed because my mother died of breast cancer, and I didn't want to give my kids all my good genes, which is lucky. And they've got enough of them. And, they just wouldn't let you gain more than 15 pounds. They wanted you to, they thought it would be better. I think it was better for them, but they said it would be better for the baby, so... I used to walk up the hill from where I worked to the doctor's office and back down again. You know, it was good exercise.
What hospital did you go to?
Swedish. I was born there. They were born there. I'll probably die there. And let's see, what was it about Swedish that I... Well, I worked at Swedish too, but not at that time. When I worked there, it was one little wing of a hospital, so not as big as it is now. They've got half the hill. And let's see, what happened with at the with the kids. Well, the kids seemed to get along fine. When my aunt passed away, we got the people we knew to come in and do babysitting, because I didn't want to leave my father alone with the children. I was too much for him. And that was the story.
Were you involved while you were involved with being a new mother, were you also active in the community at this time, or was motherhood your sole focus or main focus?
No, I was the president of the business and professional group of Hadassah, and we used to meet at my house. And then there were two of us who worked, and we had a Cub Scout group. Mm-hmm. Mothers who weren't working didn't have time for it, so after work we would meet in our basement, Jerry and I, and we would give the little boys, we'd do some chemistry experiments and stuff that was fun. And we'd march down to the playfield at night with the boys, and they would have their little ceremonies, and then they'd come back. Now, Herb was very good about that. And I had my father who would sew the badges on, because I don't know how to sew either.
Tell me a little bit then about the second child. So Dan was born 4 years later.
Uh-huh.
Was it a similar experience, or was there anything unique about that child experience?
Well, it was a different experience because you weren't knocked out. But I thought he was going to be a girl. We tried so hard. And when I found out it wasn't, you could hear me yelling shit all the way down the hall. By the way, John's first word was shit, because I am noted for being short-tempered. That's all. You know, I sure was a great example.
Why is it that you wanted a girl?
Well, my mother had just died, you know, and I thought, well, it would be nice to have somebody to name after her. But it didn't work out. We didn't get any girls until Becky. So you wait for a granddaughter.
Can you describe some of the roles and responsibilities that you and your husband shared in the child rearing?
Well, let's see. Well, Herbert's always very good about cleaning up everything. And I don't know if he ever diapered the babies or not. I don't think he knew how, but he could he'd clean up everything. He still cleans up everything, you know. We did all house cleaning together. And we did have somebody in once in a while, but he was very domestic, too. That's one thing his father taught him to do, was help around the house, even though I think they had a maid. But and he liked to garden and do that kind of thing, which I don't like to do. And we did divide things up. And he went shopping. His father had always done shopping, so I didn't have to train him in that. He did very well. And my father used to do very well in the ironing department, so I didn't have to do too much around the house.
So during this time, would you consider yourself a permissive, disciplinarian, a flexible mother? How would you describe yourself?
No, I wasn't. Herb was flexible, but I was not. I was tough. And because I was impatient, possibly, but no, quite often Herb would think about what he did, and sometimes I would just lash out. You would say it was a disciplinarian, probably. They seem to have turned out okay, but they don't discipline kids the way I did, and I think if I had to do it over again, I'd probably do the same thing, because that's your personality. You can't change it too much. I never hurt them, but I sure was tough on them.
So
but
when, yes, go ahead.
Then I was tough on my father-in-law, too, who when I wanted to, when he, when Herb went to Korea, his father said, I'll take over the checkbook. I said, no, you won't. I said, I'm perfectly capable of taking care of these things. He meant well, but he and I all often had words about it, about things, you know, because as I said, Herb is a lot like his father in some ways. And as I say to his friends, I am in charge of his humility. I try hard. It's a big job.
So how would you say that your children would then describe your parenting?
You know, I wish you would ask them that. I don't know. I think John would have said it's okay. I think Dan would have said I was a little too strict. And Dan wanted, and his cousin, Bob's son, when they were 18, decided they wanted to be out on their own, so they bought it. They rented an apartment, and they had some money from savings. And I said, well, you're out of the house. Then he got a job at Swedish Drawing Blood. That's where he met Jen. And he said, I said, you're on your own. I would do it differently now. I didn't pay for his education. And John had the GI Bill. Mm. But I think it was a little hard on him. Although, you know, you give him help too, but not as much. Sometimes I think they ate a lot of hot dogs with sawdust in it. But, you know, we all make mistakes. If I had to do that again, I would see they got an education. But John didn't need it because being in ROTC, they paid for everything. And when he came back from Vietnam, they paid for his law school.
Can you talk about, as your children grew older, what were some significant experiences that they had, that you had with them?
Well, we used to take trips together, and we'd go back to Washington, D.C., and we would see the Congress and the Senate and the museums and the House. And, yeah, we always took them on trips, and we took them on trips to New York and all, and San Francisco. We didn't take separate vacations from the children, ever.
Why not?
I think it was a good idea. You know, we didn't see that much of each other, and I thought it was a good idea if we are going across country to learn about things ourselves, to let them in on it. And in 1964, when they were quite young, we took a six-week trip across country and, you know, stopped everywhere and saw all the monuments and went to New York and then came back. This was a car trip.
Did you travel the northern route or the southern route?
Well, we traveled the northern route, and we got through the Midlands, you know, and through Minnesota and North Dakota, Nebraska, and I would say then we also got into the New York side of Canada, you know. So we had a good trip. I can't tell you too much about it except that the boys enjoyed seeing all the museums. I was surprised. John especially. John has a map in his head. And we went everywhere. We went to see George Washington's Mount Vernon, and we saw Monticello. And let's see, what else did we see? Well, we didn't go to the South at all.
Why not?
I've never cared to go to the South. We finally went there to North Carolina as we grew older, but no. And the northern part of the country was interesting. Niagara Falls, I'd never been there. And we went across to Niagara Falls through Jackman, Maine, you know. And you get an idea of how cold the country is as you go, even in the summer. And I can't make it too romantic because there was really nothing. We did stay in New York at the Waldorf because we won. What did we win? We won a trip to New York not from Seattle, but from I guess it was from San Francisco, and then we stayed at the Waldorf. Oh, we thought that was going to be wonderful. Well, since it was a paid trip, they stuck us behind the elevator shaft somewhere, so I never saw the Waldorf until I got a lot older. But and there was a Rolls Royce in front of the building, and we pictured ourselves in there. But you know, it was just kind of fun because we did fly that part of the trip. We left our little Nash car.
Were there any major conflicts or tensions in the household between you and your sons, or you and your husband, during their youth before they left home?
Oh yeah, I think we always had tensions. Herb always thought that he and his brother never fought, but his brother remembers differently. Sure, our boys fought all the time. They're still in competition. But We agreed on their upbringing pretty much, and I don't think we argued about that. We argued about other things. And of course, when John was overseas, there was a lot of tension, because he was in the harbor at Hanoi, and there was some bombing of ships there.
This was during Vietnam?
Yeah.
How old was he when he went to Vietnam?
Well, he was in ROTC, which was 22, I guess, and he was sent right over. And it's funny, because both he and I had marched against the war in Vietnam just before he went over.
Was that a march in Seattle?
Yeah.
Could you describe that march?
The march was along the freeway going to the university, and people were booing, but we all marched, and we decided that was a thing to do. Didn't matter that you had to do your duty, because it was something that was ordained, but he and I have always had the same ideas about things, and that war, I thought, was a mistake all the way through. I still do. I don't know how you feel.
I'd like to hear more about how it is that you felt strongly about Vietnam and what that was the climate in Seattle at the time.
Well, it was pretty divided. There were those people, you know, they would be maybe in your group, and not so much in my group, because so many people didn't think about it, said that I thought it was an unfair war, and that people were being singled out who had no defense, and there was no reason for it. I think that the government probably got us into the war. But afterwards, what can you do, you know? And people here were not too happy with the war. After these boys came back, nobody gave them the time of day. Korea was different. Of course, so was the Second World War.
Which Herb served in both of those.
The Second World War and Korea. Mm-hmm.
So given that you had two men in the family that were serving in different wars, did they have conflicted feelings around military involvement in Vietnam?
John did. That's why we marched, but he was made a gunnery officer aboard it was a DE. But, you know, you can't do much when you've taken your education from the country, and you kept hoping it would be all right. Dan was never interested. You have to sign up for the draft. I guess you still do when you're 18. But I think that he would never have enlisted in an ROTC deal. Luckily for John, he got back and he went to law school on the GI Bill, and that's where he met Bobby. So,
were his experiences in Vietnam, was he able to describe them while he was out there? Did he write?
They never write or talk about it at all.
Even today?
Uh-uh. In fact, Herb doesn't either. Herb talks about things more than John. But no, I still don't know what he did, except he was a gunnery officer, and I know he ran up and down the ship and up and down the rigging, too. But he wasn't ashore, so I was grateful for that. But still, a ship can be bombed, too. But no, it's funny, people don't talk about their experiences. My friends who were in the camps, every once in a while I can sit down with one of them and hear the story. They can put it on paper much better than they can tell you. So, no, I can't say that anybody except Herb, who likes to tell stories, he'd be a wonderful interview, he tells stories about what happened. But only the good ones. Once in a while, he'll tell you what happened to his friends.
So when John came back, you knew immediately, did you ask him, or you knew immediately that he could not or would not talk about Vietnam?
Well, he was reluctant to say anything, so you don't question, you know. It's bad enough that he went. And when he came back, we met him in Jacksonville, Florida, and the cab driver said, "Oh my God, that's the ship I sailed on when I was in World War II. It's been rammed once, which meant it was made over once, so it was an old ship then." But no, and he came back, he wanted to, I made him move out of the house. I said, "You'll never get married if you stick with me, you know." I never, we didn't do anything for him, but it was just easier. They always knew how to cook and make their own beds and stuff. But I thought it was a lot better. And he didn't move far away, he moved down the block, but he was on his own, and that was important. Herb was so surprised that I did that. But sometimes you have to. You have to know your own kids. So it worked out very well. Then he went to school, and the GI Bill paid it for everything. And that's one good thing. I guess we have Johnson to thank for that, don't we? So that was the story of John. Oops.
Just to go back a little bit, how is it that you and your family celebrated Jewish holidays in the home?
Well, I think that, you know, Temple wasn't exactly a Christian group, although pretty much so. We were always aware, you know, that we were Jewish, and of course there were a lot of Jewish kids in the schools we went to, and we all went to Sunday school. I was what was known as confirmed there, went there till, and I went 1 year of high school there. So we were pretty well aware of what was going on, and of course, we've always celebrated the Jewish holidays. Mother and Bev and I used to go on Friday nights too. My father was not super religious. He and his brother, they would say if you went into the synagogue, it was so surprising that one of the pillars would probably fall over. They were not terribly religious. I think it was because they came from Russia, and when they got here, they wanted to forget.
So how did you and your husband make decisions about the celebration of those holidays in your home with your children and your family?
Well, it wasn't at that time. His grandmother was alive, and so we always would go over there, which was on, it was on Capitol Hill too. She lived on 11th East, and we would have all the holidays there. Then after she passed away, her daughter had the holidays, and then my mother-in-law didn't have many. I think once a week we'd go over there or something like that, or be taken out to dinner. But I didn't have the family over a lot, because the older folks took things over. And my father-in-law kept a kosher home anyway, so it would not have been good to have him over here.
Well, your son Dan eventually became a rabbi, so
right.
I'm wondering how it is that you kept a Jewish home, even through Jewish culture, Jewish history.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have Jewish objects or crafts or things that represented a Jewish home in the way that you identified?
Well, you know, they went to Temple. Temple was an excellent educational ground for them. They were in the choir, and both John and Dan said they thought often of becoming rabbis. Well, John wouldn't have been a good rabbi. He's a great businessman and a great lawyer. Dan always, he wanted to go to medical school, but he really wasn't cut out to be a medical scientist. He's a social scientist, and he did very well in that respect. I think that actually they had enough religion from both sides of the family, not father particularly, but his grandfather, and also we have made sure that Herb made sure that he taught Sunday school, and I made sure the kids went to choir every week. I used to sit there pointedly looking at them. And I think that's what's nice about Temple, you know, not the Talmud Torah or those places, although they have their place, but they didn't give them a lot of social experience. And so the social experience, I think, made them very aware of what was going on. There was camp, too, you know, camp, or Carla, I think it was, I can't remember.
Can you spell that?
No, I don't remember where that's the right one, because it's Solomon Schechter is where the kids go now. But it was Temple Camp anyway. And John didn't like Temple Camp, but Dan did. So Dan was a good swimmer, so was John. And so they didn't excel in athletics, but they're athletic enough. Mm-hmm.
Were there any ways that you in particular tried to instill, or your husband instill, Jewish values in your children?
Well, we think we did, by example. But also, there was one thing. Our kids went to integrated schools. In fact, they were bused in. I felt that was a necessity, that too many people escaped the idea of having, you know, racially qualified schools. And they, so in our time, you could bus kids in. And we did that. They bused into the central area schools, and they bused into Garfield. And they interdated. And so, and we never asked anybody who they were taking out, whether that, what color they were, or all we wanted them to be were just nice, bright people. And that was fine.
So when you say interdated, can you be a little bit more...
Yeah, they dated people of color, and they dated non-Jewish people, probably more than Jewish people, I'm not too sure. And they, you know, I think that's the way you instill in them the idea of community, and that's what I always felt.
Where did that idea of community solidify for you?
It came from where I had been working out with other people. And also, you know, when you get yourself involved in activities outside of the community, why, you begin to understand people. And then one of John's buddies was a man of color who lived on the street. He was a young man, 18, and we would have him in the house quite often because he had no place to go. And when he came, he became quite successful. And I say that John had a lot to do with it. But, you know, there is a young woman who had dated, I think, Dan, who is still a friend of ours. And we have a young woman who is... that we call our adopted daughter. She married a Caucasian, in fact a Norwegian. She's a black young woman, and she still considers us her foster parents.
Your children grew up in the 50s and 60s, and, mm-hmm. and I'm curious if you can relate those relationships of interdating and friendships between Jews and other Caucasians in Seattle and blacks
mm-hmm.
Regionally as well to Seattle and the relations in Seattle.
Well, the relations in Seattle were, you know, it's hard to tell. The Jewish community is and has always been very, shall we say, into itself. I don't even have a good word. They were very clannish, and I think that was true of the black community and the Asian community. John dated some Asian girls in law school. These communities were sort of, didn't mingle as much in those days. But our kids, I think, were a little different. We didn't stay just with the Jewish kids. I still don't have friends who are just in the Jewish community. I have some women friends, and I like to do things with them within the community because I think it's important. And I have women friends who are not Jewish, and they know I'm Jewish, and they... And I think I'm always known as their Jewish friend. I don't fool myself about those things. But I think if you don't get out into the community the way Herb has, and I have to a lesser degree, people don't get to know you, and you can't do much good.
Why do you think that the Jewish community of Seattle remains clannish?
Because they're more comfortable with each other. It's like the other communities, the Japanese community, the Chinese community. You feel more comfortable with your own. You have to make an effort to go outside of it.
In Seattle, is there something that's helped foster that clannishness, be it that there's an ethos of community here or regionalisms? I mean, the Central District, for example, was redlined. It was Jewish at one point, and then it was black. And
yeah, well, we've never had ghettos. We've had people, as you say, it's been redlined, but there are people who were comfortable together. And the black community, as it becomes more... integrated because of money more than anything else. It was always a money thing. I don't think that anybody was, there was a covenant in some of the places. It can't be anymore. But the Highlands didn't allow Jewish people.
What is the Highlands?
It's a big order. It's a big group of people who live outside of the city. And it was a large community of very wealthy people who have a lot of land out there. And they have a Seattle Golf and Country Club, which is a very prestigious club. A lot of their wives belong to the Sunset Club, which still says, well, it can't be, you know, selective, but I still think you can't get into that club, I'm sure.